listening to the Untitled Car Show in partnership with RightFootDown.com. Visit RightFootDown for your daily automotive fix. If you enjoyed today's program, please tell a friend. It's the best way to support this show. If you want to visit the archives, go to YouTube and search for Untitled Car Show. That'll bring you to the archived episodes. If you want to follow this show, just search for Untitled Car Show on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can always send an email to the show at untitledcarshow@rightfootdown.com. We're so glad you decided to spend the next hour or so with us. Without further ado, let's get into today's program. Hello and welcome to Untitled Car Show. That is probably the first time in a long time where I actually forgot to put the microphone in front of my face. So today we are talking overlanding, which is a fascinating topic to me. I have from Opposite Lock, Pat, a.k.a. Hammerhead Fist Punch. He is a, would you call yourself an overland expert, Pat?
I think anybody that calls themselves an expert in overlanding is trying to get something sold. So I'll just say that I enjoy the sport.
Okay. So my recollection of overlanding is like the way it's always kind of sold to me by like, you know, the couple of hippies I know who have like Jeeps and say, oh, we go overlanding all the time, is basically going through like farm fields and like trails and mountains from like point A to point B just without using any paved roads. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, it's certainly a facet of it. It's kind of one of these terms that I think people have assigned a lot of different things to mean. For some people, it's just a weekend, you know, up in the mountains. It's basically what we used to call just, you know, off-roading. For some people, it's, you know, their whole life. They're out traveling from Anchorage to Ushuaia. And, you know, what used to be called expedition travel, and the term overland kind of encompasses everything in there. It's kind of come to encapsulate a lot more than I think it used to mean. So it's got some positive connotations, negative connotations, but the general idea is adventure travel based out of a vehicle. And that could be a weekend, that could be your whole life.
Well, let's kind of talk about that then. So what is your overlanding rig at the moment? Like, what's the setup you personally use?
So I've got a 1997 Land Cruiser. It's the FCJ80, because if you're a Land Cruiser guy, you have to know alphanumerics. That's really important. And I bought it at 220,000 miles, and I'm just under 300,000 now. And it's been just something I've always wanted, kind of growing up. And basic modifications, small lift, you know, a little extra armor, some electronic modifications, that kind of stuff.
And where are you, like, in the country, just so we get an idea of, like, what kind of terrain you're dealing with when you typically do this?
Well, I'm out in Utah, and a lot of the people that you'll find who are really, you know, gung-ho are out here in the West. Of course, there's a really strong Eastern scene that's growing up as well, but out here kind of in the desert is kind of my home.
Mm-hmm. So when we're talking desert overlanding, we're talking you got a lot of trails out there. So like, what's a typical, like, adventure, like what are you doing? You know, let's kind of like walk through I'm sure there varies from, you know, trip to trip, but if you're going to do a overlanding, do you call them expeditions, trip, whatever, like, talk us through, like, kind of the pre-planning, and then what takes place on the actual overlanding bit, and then kind of like if there's any cleanup or anything that's needed in the aftermath.
Sure. Well, for me, I'm kind of falling towards the extended weekend warrior type, full-time job, family, and so I only get 4 or 5 days to do any kind of trip. Mm-hmm. Out here in Utah, we have just an embarrassment of riches in terms of public land offerings, as well as, you know, national parks, that kind of stuff. And so it used to be the kind of trip planning used to be kind of, oh, well, these are the established routes. These are the trails. These are the things you want to see and do. And as I kind of got more into it, you realize that what's really fun is to just look at a map and just be like, I want to start here and I want to go here. And how can I interconnect that? So, for example, a trip I just got back from a couple of weekends ago, we had previously done the White Rim Trail in Canyonlands. It's about 100 miles. It kind of goes around the national park. It takes about 3 days to do, 2 or 3 days to do. And on the other side of the river, the Colorado River, there's kind of a lonely, forgotten basin. And it kind of connects the Moab down to the lower district of Canyonlands. This Canyonlands is separated into three districts, the Maze, Island in the Sky, and the Needles. And so I'd done each of those individually, but I kind of thought, well, I wonder if there's a way to kind of connect as much of that together as I can. And so we found, an area that kind of lends to that. And then you kind of have a loose plan, mm-hmm. Of what you want to do. And then everything kind of goes from there. In my experience, loose plans kind of go out the window and you just have to improvise a little, but that's kind of part of the fun. I mean, you can overplan, and people overplan some of these trips to death. And to be honest, it's really, really fun to plan these, you know, when you're sitting at work, and you don't want to be at work and Google Earth and you're thinking, oh man, if this connected to that and that connected to this, and how many days can I do here? And what are the conditions like? What are people saying? And you can overplan it to death. And I found that, it never goes to plan. So you may as well accept the fact that you can have a loose associated trail network and a general idea of where you want to go, and then just kind of let it happen. And then, of course, there's a lot of logistics involved. Where we were, we didn't see anybody else for several days. And so we were completely on our own, and we needed to make sure that we had sufficient water, tools, spare parts, that kind of stuff. And that's part of the fun of it, too. I don't want to say that it's an antisocial activity, but not seeing people is a plus.
Well, it's to my mind, it's what camping should be when I hear about this, because like my wife's idea of camping, which, believe me, I'll take a hotel over camping any day. But when it comes to, you know, let's go out and let's experience nature, and then you're hanging out in a forest basically with like 80 other people in close proximity just waiting to be attacked by a bear, that doesn't seem like fun. Like, you don't want to go out and experience nature with a bunch of other like dingbats you never heard of. You kind of want to go out there and be by yourself. So, you know, I imagine the typical convoy is basically either your car or maybe a couple vehicles of people you know and you kind of don't mind being around for a couple days.
Yeah, so this last trip, it was me and my friend and his brother, who are kind of the typical, we're the usual group to go out, and then we had a couple of guys join us that I didn't know. And of course, it's fun to meet new people, and there's a lot of value in that community building. Mm-hmm. A good example of what you're talking about before, the weekend after I did this trip, I was down in Zion with my family, and it was really kind of anxiety ridden for me because it took us an hour and a half to get on the shuttle because of the crowds. There was one of the, you know, those lines at Disney, the signs at Disneyland say 45 minutes from here. They actually had one of those to get on the free shuttle to take you to a hike. And, you know, I love Zion like to death, but it was a lot more anxiety and a different kind of anxiety.
Yeah. It's, you know, the point of getting away is to get away. You know, why would you want to get away to be surrounded, to basically have to go to Disney World to see nature? It seems so counterintuitive to me. It's that's kind of like the romantic idea I like about the overlanding is, you know, just being able to get out, be kind of away from everyone and be on your own. But when it comes to, you know, getting out and being on your own, how do you do, like, you know, obviously I'm sure you have like a first aid kit. You said you have water and everything. Do you bring, like, do you have to bring a satellite phone? Is a cell phone good enough? Do you have a CB radio? Like, what's kind of the just in case, you know, equipment that you have to bring with you?
Well, the kind of safety factor is debated, and of course you can go as little or as far as you feel adventurous. If it's a short trip, we'll often take, I'll take my daughter up into the mountains for an overnighter, and I don't worry too much about that kind of stuff because you'll see people. But if you're going to be in remote terrain, then you need to have some basic, the basic idea that separates like a weekend over a weekend camping trip and an overlanding camping trip is the question, what will happen if this all goes wrong? And how am I going to get back to civilization? Because the truth of the matter is that you could be 50 miles from the nearest person.
Yeah.
A good example is I was in the Maes District in the fall, in November, and the Maes District is one of the most remote places in the lower 48. And November is the off season. And we literally didn't see a single person in the 5 days that we were traveling there. We were 50 miles as the crow flies from the ranger, who was another 100 miles from the nearest hospital. Yeah. And so it kind of puts a stress on you as to, you know, how much should you take versus, you know, you take too much and then you're going to break down because your car weighs 6,000, you know, your car's overweight. Or you tip over, there's dangers and associated with that. But the basic stuff, of course, you know, you just have to have a couple days worth of water, a couple days worth of food. You got to know your vehicle and what it needs for emergency repairs. A spot transceiver is a safe bet because they're just so cheap. Well, I never have one, and I that's a terrible thing to say, but I should have one. And then just kind of your wits about you. I mean, that's the point, right? You're kind of it's so easy to kind of feel like answers and solutions are always available, but the point is to be in a place where you are the answer and you are the solution.
It's what's a spot transceiver? Just before we go a little bit further, what is that? I never heard of that before.
It's an emergency locator beacon. So, you know, the story of Aaron Ralston, I don't know if you, the man, the guy who cut his arm off in the 48 hours, that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically the idea is if you're in that kind of situation, you flip your transceiver, and he's become a big advocate of these, and it sends a frequency that's picked up by search and rescue, sends out your satellite information, they come pick you up. And then they can get fancier. You can send text messages to your family saying, I'm fine, this is my path, and that kind of stuff. And you can rent them for, it's like $7-$8 a day. It's just cheap insurance kind of thing.
It's an interesting little piece of equipment. So, like a little, like, fail-safe button almost. Like, I'm prepped from whatever, so here we go. It's an interesting, because when I was sitting there and I was thinking about this, you know, CB radio only goes so far, satellite radio needs line of sight, but that seems like a perfect little device for that. But it is interesting because I was recently watching on, you know, you get like that like hole of like YouTube videos where like you start out watching like something about cars and then like 45 minutes later you're watching, you know, some other random bullshit has nothing to do with vehicles. And you're like, how did I get from A to B? Well, I ended up on, it was a channel like where it was like primitive technology. And it was like, this guy goes out into the wilderness and he literally just makes tools with no equipment at all. And it's like water powered hammer and how that works and what you might need it for. It's like, well, this is very interesting to watch. I don't know how I got here, but that seems like it'd be a very, therapeutic way to go through life of just being like, because, you know, I'm a city slicker, for lack of a better term. I like, you know, I grew up outside Chicago, living just outside of Baltimore now. I'm used to civilization. I'm used to technology. I'm used to always having an answer at my fingertips, which is part of the reason I like hotels. But when I do find myself out and about, kind of more into wilderness, when my wife drags me along to maybe a nature hike or to the camping thing, it is interesting that, like, there's a level of awareness of what you do because help is not always at hand as it is, you know, closer into civilization. And it's almost like, have you ever, if the listener's ever given up like their cell phone for a day, like, or a couple days, like maybe it breaks, you just have to go without, or maybe like a plan's out or whatever. There's like an anxiety the first day. And then by like day three, there's kind of just like, relaxing, like, well, what did I even need that for? I'm just like back to baseline, you know.
It's a huge release.
Yeah. So when I'm thinking about this, like, there's a couple of trips I would love to take. One out here, we have, you know, a big nature trail goes down, for people who aren't from the area. Kind of like the thing that got me interested in the overlanding bit is from basically Ocean City, Maryland south. So if you're picturing like the weird funky shape of Maryland, there's an island that, or not, it's kind of an island, kind of a peninsula that takes you all the way down south to basically the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. And you can, there's like wild horses and all sorts of neat stuff, but you have to have a purpose-built off-road vehicle that meets certain criteria because it's basically a beach the whole way. And it's like, that would be so fun to do. And I guess that's technically overlanding because you kind of have to camp and find your own way and there's no real maps and the landscape is always shifting and changing. So it just seems like it'd be a very relaxing while simultaneously being a very, I'm trying to think of the word for it, like, just being forced to have your wits about you. Like, there's, like, you wouldn't think those two things could, like, coexist, but they seem like they are able to. I mean, kind of give us as the experienced one here, like, kind of give us, like, your thoughts on this. I know I rambled there for a little bit.
Well, you stumbled on something that's really legitimate. And for one thing, the point that you bring up, that you need these vehicles to get out there and do that kind of stuff, that's the whole idea. And of course, people can get caught up on, you know, building the vehicle and outfitting the vehicle and preparing for every eventuality. But the moral of the story is we're trying to get someplace. And you want to be able to access places that are difficult to find. And the reason that you want to access places that are difficult to find is because there's a catharsis in that technological release. It's really therapeutic to sit. And to give you an example, when we did the White Rim for the first time, it was a part bike and part vehicle supported trip, and we got to a point where there was no cell service, and I'm sitting at the edge of this cliff, and I sat and just didn't talk for a second, and I heard a noise in my head, and it was ringing, and it was ringing because it was so quiet that my brain didn't know how to interpret that. I took out my phone and measured the sound, and it was like 30 decibels. It was like recording studio quiet. And my brain didn't know how to process that information. And so it just sat there ringing. And there's a sensation that comes over you in those situations where there's a moment of clarity where the thing that matters is the only thing that you're doing. Mm-hmm. And there's a genuine sense when you're out there, you're always aware of the the risks that you take, although, you know, they can be mitigated to a degree with planning and foresight and, the things you talk about, bushcraft and knowledge of your surroundings and that kind of stuff. So that's always in the back of your mind, but that never really comes into the foreground. After a couple of days of just being in a place like that, your mind resets and it just starts to drop all the stuff. I was talking to somebody that's got more experience than I do, that's been doing this for a long time. And we were talking about how those are the moments that are the real moments, the ones where you have a self-awareness that this is legitimate, it's substantial, it's tangible. The stuff that we're all trying to get to in our daily lives, and we get little slivers of them. And I think that's why it's so addicting. You know, it's like the perfect surf wave or powder on a mountain. It's that moment of clarity, that moment of self-awareness that this is a real thing that you're doing that means something.
It's interesting because I know exactly that level of silence you're talking about. Driving through, so my 25th birthday present to myself was a Dodge Challenger RT, and then to drive it across the country just for shits and giggles. And it was in the Southwest. It could have even been Utah. Ended up at a rest stop, like out in the middle of nowhere, where we were off like the main highway, and it was just myself and my cousin in the vehicle. And we got out of the car, and you know, as I'm sure you can imagine, it was a 5.7 Hemi with, you know, straight pipes on it. You know, it's loud on the inside before it put the straight pipes on it. So getting out of the car and, you know, walking over to what was basically a hole in the ground, and then coming out, and like, it is so quiet that like just the knock of the engine cooling down is like the loudest thing for miles, which was just crazy. And it was an experience I remember very vividly just because of how quiet it was. And I could see how that could be, you know, very addicting. Like, you definitely can't get that out here on the East Coast. It's definitely something to the desert where there's that level of quiet out there. And I'm jealous of it in a way, because you guys got some great roads out there. You got some great driving stuff. And just the thought of being able to like go to the national parks and experience that just sounds, you know, like a wonderful time. I'm curious. So you have the vehicle prepped. How do you sleep? Like, do you bring a tent, sleeping bags? Do you have like a rooftop box? Like, what is your kit for that?
So I was just actually having a conversation about this. I'm kind of the administrator over at Overland.Kinja, and we kind of have a discussion about this, about how do you sleep best. And I've slept in just about everything. I've got a nice 10x10 canvas tent that I love to death, and I've got, you know, backpacking tents. I've slept under the stars. I've slept in hammocks. And my best sleep, unquestionably, is inside my truck. And I know that sounds like really weird, in the sense that like you're 3 days in the wilderness, you're starting to get a little ripe. Why would you, and you're driving 12 hours a day, why would you want to spend more time in your car? But it's just so peaceful for me. I think part of it's just the fact that it's secure and quiet and flat. But yeah. I think a lot of it's just a sense of it feels like, well, the way I would describe it would be, that feeling that you get when you're, it's a heavy rainstorm, for example, and you know you're safe and warm inside. It's just a pleasant feeling knowing that your vehicle is your home, and it's your transportation, it's your everything while you're out there.
There, again, my limited experience with camping, you know, but the few times I've gone, I almost always find myself like, I'll just sleep in the car. And the two vehicles, one was a C30, the other one was a Ford Fiesta sedan. So neither one is what you would call a roomy vehicle, but I still slept so much better inside that than I did in the tent. Now, how do you mitigate the kind of, you know, it getting too hot when the sun starts coming out, or, you know, just like the, you know, the condensation from you being inside the vehicle when it's kind of cold outside and it's warm inside? Or do you even give a crap?
Well, condensation doesn't really matter to me. I mean, it's like 10% humidity where I travel, and so that's never an issue. But it does get hot. There's some products. I travel with my uncle who's got a similar truck, and he puts that Reflect-X material up in the windows, which is really nice because it keeps the sun out. You can sleep in. Mm-hmm. There's these great window socks, and I can't remember the name of them, but they're basically just a net like a fine mesh that you slip over your window, and then you attach a magnet strip to the outside, and it seals it. You can leave your windows open all night. It's really nice.
That sounds like a perfect solution. So, I'm really fascinated by that. So I'm gonna have to go look into that, because I don't know. It's one of these things too, where as a person who has a wife who's not interested in vehicles as much as she is in adventure, this seems like a perfect excuse to be like, well, we have the Fiesta and we have the Escape, but what we really need now is we need a vehicle to go overlanding in. So, you know, just another one. So, because four vehicles for two people, that or well, me, my wife, and the kids. So four vehicles for three people, that's good, right? So, yeah. I don't know, what is, I'm sure there's multiple opinions on this, but we have your ear. So, like, what's your idea of a good entry-level vehicle for someone who's thinking about getting into this?
Well, so here's my philosophy, and it's the same philosophy that I give to anybody who wants to start skiing or start biking. Get what you have. If it's a piece of crap, then it's a piece of crap. It's tempting, especially if you have the means, to just go out and find something that's pre-built or find something that kind of fits that mold. But just go out on what you have. The idea is, and it can be very addicting to modify, to attach, to window shop, because the market has exploded recently, and there's just so many options, and there's highly sponsored YouTube channels and things that get you really excited to get out there. And you can just go nuts. And people, and I, no offense, because you know what? That modifying scene, that's really pleasurable. You know, you go with your friends and you weld up something, that's really fun. But the trick is you're trying to get someplace. So my advice is to go with what you have and find out what the limits of those are, and find out what the limits of you are. Find out if they're incompatible. So, you know, you want to go farther than your vehicle does, or you get to a point where you think, well, I'm going to get stuck and this isn't for me, and kind of work your way up from there. You know, for one perspective, it's the way to enjoy it more. I mean, we enjoy going from crappy to better to best. It's no fun to jump right into best. You skip all the fun learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very good point to that. It's just like, for what's a good platform, do you think, for someone who's trying to get into this? Is the Jeep the best for this? Is a, you know, Land Cruiser best for it? Are we talking about, you know, are they all kind of equal? Like, do you not recommend pickup trucks? Like, is there a platform out there that you've seen just not ever work? And is there something where, you could recommend a specific platform? You know, like, kind of like in that. And then I got a different question in my head that might answer this as well. So, like, I don't know.
Well, so to answer your first question there, you always plan for your expedition. So if you, an overlanding truthfully is 80% on the road. And if you live in a place where you need to travel a great distance to get anywhere, then you need to have a vehicle that's going to be comfortable on the road, that's going to get good mileage. You can do a lot with a Subaru, with an SG Forester or an XV or an Outback. You put a puck spacer on there. You can do a lot with those. And then of course, you know, depending on your budget, there's XJ Cherokees. Those are a dime a dozen. You can build those up really reliably. And then, of course, there's brand preference. I've always been a Toyota guy, and the 80 kind of called to me, but I realized that there's a lot of great trucks out there. My last trip, we had a Frontier. That's a killer bargain. That truck did really great. We had a Tacoma and then a TJ Jeep, a two-door. Had two guys in it and just stuffed to the brim with all their camping gear. But had no lockers, a mild lift, 31-inch tires, and they did it. You know, we had to stack rocks, but they did it. They had a great time.
So, kind of to that same point, so what are the vehicles you've personally owned for the overlanding in particular?
Well, so my 4x4 experience starts back with an Isuzu Rodeo, and then I had an XJ Cherokee, and then a TJ Wrangler. And then the experience of, you know, my early years gave way to the realities of I needed a reasonable car to be a family car. So I got a Forester. I had an SG Forester, the XT. And it was a good car. It took us, me and my wife, to some really neat places. But I found that I had reached my limits again, and I was willing to sacrifice some usability, some creature comforts, some speed, a little economy for something that I just wanted. You know, the car that I have now genuinely is more capable than I'm likely to use it for. I mean, I have a locker in all three of my differentials, front, center, and rear, and I'll put them on from time to time to make something easier. And it's almost to the point where there's not a ton of challenge before I worry about just smashing the crap out of it. So yeah, it's more than I need. And there's a spectrum of overlanding. Like I say, there's the rock crawlers and the people who are out there doing just really hard stuff. But the truth of the matter is that the really enjoyable trips are most likely done in two-wheel drive. We did a trip that was 5 days through Grand Staircase Escalante. It was 300 off-road miles, and most of it could have been done in an Outback. And we saw the coolest stuff.
It's so fast. I mean, are there towns or are there like outposts or, you know, specific sites that like in the Southwest that like, I'm sure there's a ton of sites you can't see otherwise, but you know, are there some landmarks out there that like people can only access via overlanding that you think are really particularly like worth going and seeing?
Oh man, there's so much. And I don't want to sound like there's not great stuff elsewhere, because truthfully, there's, you know, I have huge desires to do some stuff on the East Coast and stuff down in Texas and on the West Coast and stuff like that. In Utah particularly, we just have a lot of open land. And there's stuff that you can see in a four-wheel drive that you can't see anywhere else. A good example would be Capitol Reef National Park. It's one of the five that we have here, and it's not one of the more visited ones. And it's beautiful. If you go into the campsite, it's gorgeous. But there's a very popular road called Cathedral Valley Loop that goes kind of north and loops around. It's about 50 miles. And you have to cross a river right off the bat to get into it. And so it's kind of a gatekeeper, but it really is the treasure of the park. And anybody that's ever been to Capitol Reef will say, yeah, you have to do Cathedral Valley Loop if you want to get to it. And the whole state is littered with that kind of stuff. For example, the Maze District, when I mentioned that was very remote,
yeah.
Just to get to the ranger station is 40 miles on a dirt road. That's just to get into the park, to access the entrance to the national park. Or there's on the other side of the river, the Needles, there's some amazing campgrounds that are national park property that you can't get to without a vehicle. And so it, to some extent, you really need to have a vehicle to experience some places. Utah is one of those places where if you really want to experience it, you need a vehicle or you need a lot more time than most people have. Of course, people go into the Maze, takes 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and all respect to them, but I'm really stoked about my AC in my fridge.
Yeah, not sweating the balls off and being able to bring beer with you are like two perks I'm always down for. So when it comes to like, you know, you're out in Utah, there's a lot of little creepy, like crawly things around there. And some other places there's like bears and foxes and stuff. Have you ever had like a run-in with anything?
So bears scare the ever-loving crap out of me, despite the fact that there's like no genuine risk for me for the most part. Other than that, the desert doesn't really scare me. I don't big cats, they stay away from you. They don't bother you. The only close encounters I've ever really had are rattlesnakes. I've almost stepped on a rattlesnake before. I've almost flipped over on my bike right onto my back on a rattlesnake. For the most part, it's just, they leave you alone, you leave them alone, and to be honest, they hear you coming They hear you coming a mile away. They don't want anything to do with us.
That's good. You got like scorpions and crap down there too. Like all like the big ass like insects and arachnids. That's like my one thing that kind of keeps me away from like wanting to like adventure and like get out and experience the wilderness in like the Southwest is I don't like bugs. But you're saying not a big bug problem out there? Or do you just have a secret?
No, I'll tell you, part of the reason that I like sleeping in my car and part of the reason that rooftop tents are particularly attractive is because there's stuff on the ground. I mean, it may not be a big deal. It may be like millipedes, but there'll probably be some spiders. Spiders that aren't going to hurt you, but spiders that are crawling around on your face makes for makes for an unpleasant night's sleep. So yeah. I like being in my truck because they're down there and I'm up here. And so that's, you see it, I mean, out here in the West, generally, I don't know what it's like elsewhere, but rooftop tents are just, they're exploding. They're everywhere. Like you can't go down the street. I can't go to work without seeing five. Why you leave them on your car all day, I have no idea, but that's what's happening these days. Overland jewelry, I guess.
Yeah.
But I see the appeal. There's some real appeal of getting up off the ground. And to be honest, it's really easy to mitigate. You get a cheap tent, they leave you alone.
That's good to know. When it comes to your experiences doing the overland stuff, have you ever gotten stuck anywhere where you had to, you know, walk a distance or maybe hop on a bike to like go get some help to like get you out? Or was there ever a fear or like maybe a worse breakdown you had out there?
So I have terrible luck. Most of the times I go out, it doesn't go to plan, as I mentioned before. We did a 4-day expedition where we were about to go down a hill called Rose Garden Hill in Moab. And it's about a 45-degree slope with 6-foot drops. As far as the rocks, they kind of drop you down in little 4 to 6 foot steps. And then it's off camber and on a cliff. And it started pouring when we got to that. So we had to turn around. And then when I went into the maze, this was actually the most scared I've been. We went in through a southern route that had washed out, and it was a genuine challenge to get in there. I mean, we were using our traction boards. The road had washed out in one area, and we had to kind of find an alternate path. And we'd gotten ourselves really, really deep into the maze, like I said, 50 miles to the nearest person as the crow flies. There's no rescue. There's no help. Coming back on that road to get to the next night's campground, my car sputters and stops. And I think, okay, this sucks. So I get out and I smell burnt electrical. So I think, okay, well, I've read the forums. I know the kind of places to start looking. The truck has three main fusible links that are kind of the lifeblood of the electrical system, and one of them had fried. I'd bought a spare part because this had been told to me is kind of a common problem of these trucks. The wiring just gets older and the loads can just overload this fuse. So I put in the spare, fires right back up, feeling awesome. And this is a technical road out. It's not like we're in 4 low, we're going 5 miles an hour, we're climbing up and over things. And so I go up a hill, and a puff of smoke stalls out again. And this time I'm out of my spare. I'm still in the same situation I was before, but we don't know what's shorted on the truck.
Yeah.
And so we start diagnosing. And fortunately, the two guys that I have with me, one is a literal rocket scientist and the other works for a large airline company building parts of their wings. They're smart guys. So we pop the hood off. I've got the hood off, and these two guys are sitting on top of my engine, just tearing all the plastic apart, trying to trace the leads back. Turns out that a previous owner, sometime in the truck's past, had cut an injector lead and spliced it back together. Actually did a pretty good job. It was soldered and it had a insulating cover, but it had worn away and it was shorting on the intake manifold.
Mm.
So we eventually figured that out, and I had to tear up my some other electrical part of my car that I had put on just so that I could hodgepodge together a fuse system. And it just, it was terrifying to know that, like, my getting out of there with my truck was on me, because frankly, very little should be on me. I'm not that knowledgeable of a guy. And so it scared the crap out of me. Fortunately, our little bodge held together. We lost the 2 days that we were hoping to get, that we had permits for, but we did make it out, and found out that, we had a really good time. We had a really good rest of the adventure, and truthfully, it's the most memorable trip I've had.
Yeah.
Working together with my friends, just everything that we had to do to struggle to get there. We did one hike out of like six we had planned, but it is the most memorable trip I've had by far.
Well, that's interesting, because the listeners know I recently did the Lemons Rally, and I suffered mechanical breakdown after mechanical breakdown before the car just basically quit on us. And it sucks in a way that you don't get to fulfill everything you wanted to do. But on the other end, coming out of something, A, alive, and B, with a good story to tell, is almost more worth it than being able to do the trip you initially planned to do. So I'm wondering, have you come across other people broken down and helped them out, or pulled some complete strangers out of mud puddles or stuff like that? Or is that just kind of like a romantic fantasy I have in my head about the overlanding?
Well, you know, I love the community because, for the most part, everybody likes to give people hard times, but it's an extremely tight-knit community that is absolutely willing to help people out. I'm trying to think if I've actually helped anybody out more than just advice. I don't think I've ever had to put a tow strap or anything on anybody else's vehicle that wasn't in my party, but you do see it all the time. Like that Cathedral Valley loop I'd mentioned before, somebody had done it backwards in a rental. It was like a Ford Escape or something like that. And it was, he got to the river and it was cross the river or go 50 miles around back. And so, you know, you stop in the river, you help him out, you make sure you spot him.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to make sure that you're helping other people out, because it comes back around, of course. And even in the party, people don't hesitate. You know, if they're through the obstacle, they jump right out of their truck. They're stacking rocks for you. They're spotting for you. It's a real, it's nice. There's no sense of, there's no sense that, that this is your journey alone.
It seems like it's a very, us versus nature kind of, attitude to the whole thing when you go out as a group.
I don't even say us versus nature. It's more just us versus the thing that is preventing us from moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very in the moment thing. And it's per challenge, per obstacle. You're not thinking about what's coming next. You just think, well, if we get past this, then we're moving forward, and that's good.
It like we said earlier, it seems like a very like crystallized, like uncut, pure expression of the love of the mechanical and the automotive. And I've used this quote before, but James May talks about how he doesn't get auto racing because the point of the car was not to go around and ride back where you came from. It was the great liberator of people so they could get from, you know, basically any point on a continent to any other point on the continent, no matter what's in their way, where they really couldn't do that before in speed and comfort. And I paraphrase the living crap out of that, believe me, but the expression and the joy and the thing, you know, when you turn 16, the thing you really want to, the reason you want a car is so you can get out of the house. You can go do stuff. You can go hang out with your friends, and it doesn't matter where they are or what time it is or whatever. And the overlanding in all of its many guises seems to be the ultimate kind of man and machine and nature bonding experience, kind of the ultimate expression of what vehicles were intended to do and what you, what I think every real automotive enthusiast should do at least once in their life. So,
yeah, I think it's easy to, I think it's very, very easy to romanticize that, that concept. And to a degree, there's a lot of truth to it. There's a couple of types of overlanders, and there are types out there that are checklist types. And to be frank, you know, that was how I started. It was, you know, I'm going to do this trail and I'm going to do this trail and boom, I'm going to knock it off and boom, I'm going to knock it off. And as I've gone further and further down that path, I realized that the value is less about specific accomplishments, marking things off your list, or even overcoming challenges. Of course, you can build your car up to do just anything, and then it'll do it. The goal is to find that moment where you get the maximum amount of value from the life that you're living then. And I have a family, and I love camping with my family. I like my job. I have a life that I enjoy, but there's a sense of a high concentration of genuine human experience when you get to places that are solitary. There's a lot, we joke a lot, and I'm guilty of this more than most, that there's a lot of bromance in the overland community right now. I don't know if you're into this, the ski films or whatever, but there's a lot of soul bro that exists in these communities, and all these overlanding videos always start out with some swelling music, and the spirit of adventure is the soul of man, you know. There's a lot of, the wink is strong, as the saying goes.
Yeah.
But the truth is just get out there and find out what that feeling is. You know, I try my best not to overly flower it up. But the truth is, it feels really good. It's addictive. And that's why people do it. That's why people should do it. It's to get out. I mean, I took my 4-year-old on the White Rim, and we had a great time. To get out, experience that with her and see the joy in her face, to get out with my friends and really get to know them in an intimate way, and to get out and see stuff that is just perspective shifting. Now, that's the point. And like I say, not to philosophize it too much, but that's where people should be getting out of overland. It shouldn't be, you know, hashtag life, Instagram success, because that's out there. Yeah. It should be an experience that enriches your life.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting point. So, like a lot of these, you know, you said bro, and like, you know, there's an attitude associated with it, and there's a lot of people who drive around bro trucks, for lack of a better word for them, you know, truck nuts dangling off the back, who have never taken their vehicle off-road once. And, you know, I'm sure, though, those individuals, when they do go off-road, are, let's say, obnoxious at best. Is there some fellow overlanding pet peeves that you kind of have gotten over the years? Like seeing other people do X, Y, or Z that you're just like, you shouldn't be doing that while you're out here, you know, experience this wonderful thing with the rest of us.
Well, there's a lot of the overland jewelry. And I think a lot of people either overemphasize or just miss the point entirely as to what the point of accessorizing a vehicle is. And to be honest, if they're after just the look and that's their thing, that's fine. But it really should be a functional thing that gets you there. And then, of course, when you're out there, you can't spend time in places that are amazing and not develop a respect for those places. And so you see a lot of stuff that that worries you in terms of going off trail, lots of party trash, you know, broken beer bottles, that kind of stuff, big, huge fires up against the rock that scar the rock. And a lot of that is just, you know, a newness and inexperience. But you can tell the people who've done it a long time because all of that drops away, all the pretense drops away, and you just start to develop a rapport with your vehicle, for one, because you start to lose the stuff that doesn't matter, and for the land. And so, you know, in terms of stuff that just drives you crazy out there, just don't blast your music all across the land. Don't smash your beer bottles. Just realize that you're here for the experience and not because it's going to be a really, really cool, you know, Instagram post.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not, was it the Friar Festival, whatever that was, that disaster? Kind of dating this episode here, but yeah, it like it's just so fascinating to me that there's this pretense, like you said, of these people who like go off-roading and go mudding or whatever, and then the flip side of that of like, I can't really imagine if you, like, my big thing with my wife is, you know, I knew that we could get married because we would road trip a lot and we didn't murder each other after we road trip. And I can't imagine like a more pure version of trying to get to know someone than, you know, you can't use your cell phone. You can't, you know, like run away to entertainment. You're just in the car. So have you been, I'm sure you've been with your wife. You said you went with your daughter. Have you gone out as just like a whole family unit just to experience like, you know, life in Utah as like, you know, a big old family unit?
It's funny. My wife won't go with me because she has a phobia of rocks. She'll do easier trails with me, but if there's like a chance that there's any rock climbing involved, she is out and she won't go with me. But yeah, so we do have a pop-up tent trailer and we'll go and base camp, and she has no problem being off the grid in that respect. And so I love my family time. It's very different from my overlanding time. And my friends that go with me, some of them do bring their families. I've got my friend with the Tacoma. He's got this rooftop tent, and I don't know how he does it because it's a two-person, maybe a three-person rooftop tent. He's got he and his wife and a two-year-old and a four- or five-year-old, and they all sleep up there. And they're just troopers. He took when we did the White Rim with my five-year-old, they had a six-month-old with them.
Wow.
And they went, my hat's off to them because that was intense. Literally, they were intense then.
It's a bad time. Well, it's interesting because I can't imagine, you know, there's a great picture I enjoy of like the, if you've ever seen like a B-52 where they like lay out like all the ordnance, like that the B-52 can carry out in front of the plane. It's just like an absolute massive stockpile. Some genius a couple years back did the same thing with like his kid's diaper bag, like for like a 6-month-old, and just all that crap laid out in front of him. I can't imagine trying to, like, you know, I did it with a 6-month-old for a day or for like a week in civilization, and that was crazy. I can't imagine doing that with a 6-month-old out in, you know, the middle of nowhere. But I guess it speaks to just be prepared and know what you need to bring, you know?
Yeah. It was a little, I mean, the latest trip that we did, we got into trouble there as well. My cruiser had brake problems for a couple of days before, and so we got a late start. When we got onto the trail, about halfway through, it poured. It was just pouring. It wasn't supposed to be any rain at all. Of course, that happens to me before. I've been struck by lightning on a 20% chance of rain day. So you just, in Utah, you just don't trust the weather. You just have to be prepared. And he has his five-year-old with him out there. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, okay, well, if we have to wait this out a couple of days, do we have enough food? Do we have enough water? And you try to eliminate the scary things in your mind, but there's some real risk to it. But truthfully, that's, you have to have that in order for you to really feel that experience. Mm-hmm. Turned out to be totally fine. We were able to continue forward, but you know, you just have to be prepared for the unexpected. That's the number one thing. If I had to say to anybody that wanted to get started in this, is just make sure that you are not going to die if you can't see anybody for 2 days. Yeah. And then just go. Just get out there.
Well, speaking of getting into this, I'm going to ask you for some good resources for that. But on the flip side, you got struck by lightning?
Yes. Yes, I did.
I think that's a first for the show, just so you're aware.
We were hiking.
Yeah.
Like I said, we were going to go with the scouts. Of course, it was with the scouts. Mm-hmm. We're going up into the mountains, and it was supposed to be a 20% chance of lightning. And the storm, we saw it go east to west, as it typically does. And then it stopped and turned around and went west to east, which is really atypical. And it just got really intense, really fast, and started hailing on us. And we had a group of five of us or so, and huddled under a tree, waited for the storm to pass. Well, turns out trees are Faraday cages, and the air was statically charged. So as soon as we stepped out from under the tree, we thought we were safe. Boom, flash of light. We're all on the ground. We've got this 6 foot, 250-pound, 14-year-old scout soaking wet with his backpack that is unconscious. We have to drag up the hill under the tree, and that was something else. It was a fun one.
Buried the lead with that. So, did you ever have any bad experience? Well, I got stuck once and had to like redo a distributor. You got struck by lightning.
Yeah. We've also had the guy I also go out with, this family man, the day before he got his adopted son, we were biking together and he broke his back and neck. So we've had some interesting experiences together, he and I.
It sounds like, again, like 30 minutes ago, we could have delved deeper into those stories. But it's, I mean, so you've learned some of these lessons the hard way when it comes to being safe out there, obviously, given those two stories and the breakdown and all that stuff. So, really, I guess kind of the lesson learned is if you're in the vehicle, you have that level of protection built in. And then kind of once you get out and away from the vehicle, that's when you have to really have your wits about you, because you are out in the middle of nowhere and you don't even have your vehicle to rely on in case you slip or fall or like a storm rolls in and all that. So,
well, there's something interesting that I heard along these lines recently, and I think it's really good advice. They call it the rule of threes. Mm-hmm. Can you survive the next 3 minutes, 3 hours, or 3 days? And so 3 minutes, car fire, can you put that out? Mm-hmm. 3 hours, do you have shelter? Are you safe? 3 days, can you survive if you don't have your vehicle? And if you kind of just follow that basic premise, you know, you can get carried away in safety, and I tend to do that. But if you follow that basic premise, then whatever you're going to do, you're going to be fine. And just so long as you keep your head on, you know, you'll be all right.
I mean, it's good advice. To that end, for people who are interested in getting into overlanding in, you know, the beginning phases of it, besides, was it overlanding.kinja.com?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a good one. Do you recommend any other resources for people to go check out?
Well, it depends on where you are, of course. There's the major source expedition portal, and there's local sites. There's a couple of good West Coast ones, overlandbound.com, or Vermont Overland is the East Coast one. There are so many resources online, and a lot of it's good. My advice is to get excited about it. There's a lot of great, really great free YouTube out there. Andrew St. Pierre White, Ronnie Dahl, All for Adventure, 4X Overland, or Expedition Overland, and Vermont Overland, and they just get you. That's the thing. Get excited about it, and then go and find out what you don't have and then come back and buy, build, or work around that and go out again.
Mm-hmm. And if someone were to come to Utah and say, or someone who's living in the Utah area, and they want to do a trail, is there, you know, I know you've talked about a couple of these, is there a particular state park or a particular trail you have to do in your mind in Utah?
Oh, man.
See, these are the hard questions.
Oh, gosh. It really depends on what you've seen and what you haven't, because the truth is there's a lot of stuff that you can access relatively easy, and, you know, how long you're here for. Try getting off the beaten path a little bit in terms of there's the five national parks, and they're all wonderful, but do a little homework. Arches National Park, for example, has a road that goes into it that's off-road called Willow Flats, and that takes you to some really cool stuff where people aren't. Or you can come in Salt Valley Road, for example. Or if you go down towards Capitol Reef, there's Cathedral Valley. And truthfully, you don't need much to do these kinds of roads. You could, a rental Ford Escape could get you to these kind of places. Mm-hmm. If you're going to see some of the really cool stuff Utah has to offer, take a little extra time and see what's there that's not going to have people in it. Zion is my perfect example for this. And I don't do a ton of hiking, but my wife got me into canyoneering a few years ago, where we'd go do Technical Slot Canyon. And I'd been to Zion for years and years, and never really got past the fact that, you know, there's big cliffs and there's a river and it's very beautiful. But when we got down into some of these technical slot canyons, and they were filled with owls and ferns and just these miniature oases, and it just changed everything for me. And it was literally the start of this trail that changed everything for me was underneath the road that everybody drives over. The mm-hmm. RVs are driving over. You just went underneath the road, and that's where the trail started.
Hmm. It's fascinating. There's just like a big can of worms, like a layers of an onion going here, where like she's afraid of rocks, but you're going canyoneering.
A very strange dichotomy of fears. I'll tell you that.
Uh-huh. People are fascinating. That's why I love this program. But we're kind of at our marker here. Before we go, I have a question I like to ask of all guests. So I'll ask you, what is the hardest food to eat while driving? And I'm sure you've had some experience while you were overland.
The hardest food to eat while driving?
Yep.
Oh, man. Take me a minute to think about that. I hate eating and driving. I hate it.
Your whole life is in the car. You sleep in the car. Eating in the car, that's a step too far.
Driving. I hate pulling up to a Wendy's and trying to eat while I drive. I hate that. I think that's so annoying. But, so here's what you don't do. You don't have open sunflower seeds or trail mix in your car, because that will always end in tears.
That's a good one, and very specific to, I like a trail mix and trail driving. It's
that will end in tears. If you have something that is like a particulate system, there's like 1,000 little BBs of food,
yeah.
Don't leave that open when you're going over. That's a bad idea.
Good. That is a good one. That's going up on the leaderboard I need to make one day. Pat, it was an absolute delight to have you on today. I'm sure I could pick your brain for another, like, you know, couple hours here, but fortunately we have time limits here. So,
well, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Oh, I'm glad you had fun. Let's go ahead and I'll give you the opportunity to plug whatever you want to plug right now, and then I'm going to say goodbye to you off air.
There's nothing much to see. We run the overland.kinja.com. We're one of the few bastions of sponsor-free overland sites on the internet, and it's just been such a huge blessing to know and meet some of the people that are on there. So please come say hi. We have some of just the coolest people all across the world that just are passionate about this and happy to share.
All right. Excellent. So everyone listening, I'll be right back. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to get in contact with the show, you can do so by sending an email to untitledcarshow@rightfootdown.com. You can help support the show by going to trackmonkeyapparel.com, and there's a Right Foot Down clothing line option on that page. Go there. If you like the designs, buy a Right Foot Down t-shirt. They're monthly, so they should be refreshing every month. When it comes to, there will be a run of Untitled Car Show shirts on the site. I just don't know when exactly that's going to happen. When that does happen, you'll be hearing a lot from me because, like, so you support the site, which helps support me, which helps me do what I need to do. But then when that particular shirt design comes out, most of that revenue will be going to me instead of to the site, and it'll be back and forth with all that stuff. So that's kind of the plan with that. So thank you in advance for all that. Thank you to TrackMonkeyApparel.com for helping support Right Foot Down and the Untitled Car Show. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to follow me, you can do so by going to at Untitled Car Show on Twitter. That's also good on Instagram. You can search for Untitled Car Show on Facebook. You can send me an email. Like I said, you can follow our West Coast correspondent. That's Ryan West at Ryanator122. And you can just send him random tweets. Ask him how West Coasting is going. I think he's in the process of like schoolwork. Something. I don't know what he's doing right now, but I'll harass him because he probably deserves to be harassed. So, let me think what else is going on here. I think that's all the plugs. Be on the lookout for YouTube stuff. We're going to be having some more of that maybe coming out. That's the plan. And thank you everyone so much for listening. Seriously. So if you like the show, tell a friend, tell a loved one, tell a coworker. Just do what you can. Watching those download numbers go up every week is phenomenal. It's, you know, taking the world slowly by storm in a way. So thanks everyone again so much for listening. Have a good night. Have a good evening. Wherever you are, whatever time it is there, thank you so much for listening. Please be safe out there.